Everybody, I'd like to welcome you to the Permanency Support Program podcast. My name is Morag MacArthur and I'm a children's researcher. I've spoken to lots of children over the last 25 years about their lives, about how they'd like to be supported in the service system, some of which I'll share with you today. So there's three main areas that I am going to discuss. The first thing is to reinforce why it's so important to talk to children in your practice, and to also identify what children say about what they need in those developing relationships. Secondly, I'm going to spend some time thinking about some of the barriers that might get in the way for practitioners to talk to children in the way they would like. And finally, a brief sort of foray into the principles and tools that you might be able to use in your practice. From our research, I'll try and tell you what kids had to say about what they want you to know, what they might want you to think about how they would like to be spoken to and encouraged to participate. You might want to think about how child-centred your current practice is while I'm talking. And you might have some fantastic tips that you can share with others about talking to children. So let's get started. Why is it so important to talk to children? Well, there's lots of reasons, actually, about why you need to talk to children. But the first thing is it's because it's their right. Most of you would know that in 1989, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child recognised the rights of children to express their views and have their voices heard. This convention declared in Article 12 that the children have the right to participate in decisions that affect their lives in accordance with their age and maturity. And so this beholdens us to consult with children on decisions that concern them. It goes on to acknowledge children's vulnerability, but strongly promotes children as active citizens who can make their own decisions about their best interests, holding rights to participate and protection. This big change to the way children were seen in terms of a human rights framework has also been used to frame the legislation around children and child protection, as well as policies that inform your practice every day. We carried out a study quite recently with practitioners asking them to talk about how they saw participation of children in their practice and why they thought it was important. And practitioners articulated the value of talking to children in two main ways. One seems self-evident, that children are often and should be the centre of child protection practice, and they have the rights enshrined in legislation to participate in their decision making. The second key reason they thought it was important is that children's needs and wishes have to be heard directly if possible to best keep them safe. So apart from children and young people being the key client of child protection, it was recognised by some participants that children and adults see the world differently and that children can have different worries and needs to those adults might identify. One worker reflected this view when they noted how concerns reported to child protection, for example, came from adults. And when speaking to the child, they might be worried about different or additional things. In the context of the Permanency Support Program, there's a lot of adults around children whose views might be sought. The practitioner went on to say, I mean, the whole basis of child welfare is to see the child's view through their eyes, seeing their worldview through their own lens, so that caseworkers can form a positive relationship with every child in order to understand what their needs are. This was important and key to the practitioners when in talking about valuing children's participation. There's also a lot of research that shows that understanding what children need leads to improved services and decision making because they are more responsive to children's needs. A practitioner said they're the ones that are going to be able to tell you how they're feeling, what they want, what their dreams are, what their fears are, and what their hopes are. A parent or a carer or a friend can't tell you that. So you need to keep the child at the centre of all conversations and all of your paperwork. In practice, positive outcomes include enhancing the quality of services, increasing the accuracy of decision making, and ensuring that services are more responsive to children's needs. This will improve outcomes for children and their protection. Strong participation can improve practice and care arrangements, increase the self-esteem of children, and lead to an increase in their overall well-being. So apart from supporting them to have rights as citizens and service users, the research has demonstrated that decision-making amongst children develops confidence and proficiency in enacting agency in their lives. And finally, that children have a very strong desire to be listened to. One child in a very early study of ours said, "You need to talk to kids about their lives because kids see the world differently to grown-ups." Or another young person who said, "Yeah, everyone's different. What I need is like different to my brothers. There was stuff that I needed to know because if I didn't know, I'd be stressed. But my brother said he didn't want to know. He felt better being in a daze, not stressed out." The point being that assumptions around what children think need to be addressed. What else do children say? Because despite the benefits associated with participation, most of the research that's assessed children's participation in various contexts, including child welfare, has found that the reality is far from its intentions. Research with children indicates that they often feel that they're engaged in decision-making at the wrong times, in ways that aren't really very effective for them, and at times to the detriment of their sense of autonomy and interdependence with others. Other studies say that they experience the processes of services as very unfriendly, and they're often sceptical about the meaningfulness of their involvement. In a research review of multiple studies, it showed that most children and young people felt that they are rarely consulted, and that they have limited opportunities to participate in decision-making processes in child welfare. Other studies show that children do not feel appropriately informed about the decisions being made and remain powerless, voiceless, and fearful in these processes. This is despite research finding that practitioners say that they are very confident in ascertaining the wishes and feelings of children and that they are very positive about children's participation. The research also shows that when children are able to give their views, this is often because of the attitudes of individual workers rather than embedded procedures in systems or organisations. This makes the availability of meaningful participation very unpredictable. And one young woman said about her experience at a meeting, a case planning meeting. "That was it," she said. "Nothing happened. Nothing changed. That sounds about right. You put in 100% and then you wait years and years to hear anything back. I've left care by the time anything has actually happened." Or another young person who said, "You can ask anybody who's been in care. I know loads of them who just step back and let things happen because they just can't do anything." Okay, so on the one hand, we have quite a lot of research with practitioners who say how important participation is and how they value it and how they feel confident that they can do it. On the other hand, we have children and young people saying, "Actually, it doesn't work very well for me." We also have a lot of research about what some of the barriers might be to practitioners talking to children in the ways that they want to. I've just recently read a PhD of workers in a program, funded programs in the child welfare system in another jurisdiction. And there was a lot of discussion about what the key barriers are to speaking to children. And one of the first ones is about how practitioners deeply see children. How do they construct children and their competencies and capabilities? Historically, children have been seen as passive without the agency to influence their development or the relationships, systems, or structures around them. In contemporary Western thinking, children are frequently thought of as dependent, in need of protection, powerless, and irrational. And this is because there are structures in our society that lead us along these lines. For example, the age-based schooling system, which tells us that a 10-year-old should be doing A, B, and C. Or the need for parental consent for so many activities for children to engage in. And age restrictions on things like driving and alcohol and criminal responsibility. These all highlight assumptions about children's competencies. The second key barrier that practitioners often talk about is a lack of confidence in engaging with children. And this is articulated in a range of ways. One is they are worried that when speaking to children, they will raise things that they don't feel confident to be able to respond to. They are worried about not providing a therapeutic experience to children. They are worried about re-traumatising children. I'd have to say there's almost no evidence at all that practitioners or researchers or other adults that talk to children about their lives lead to further re-traumatisation. Most children, when asked about this, will say, well, this is my life. Like, this is my life. So there's a lack of confidence around there. And there's also a worry that by talking to children directly, that parents, very vulnerable parents, might feel undermined by this discussion with children. Time, pressures work as a barrier. Practitioners talk about a lot of paperwork that needs to be done, a huge amount of administrative work that needs to be done that gets in the way of finding the time to talk to children. Although one practitioner in the PhD I mentioned earlier said that it was hard for her to imagine how she could do the paperwork without talking to the child or young person. Another key structural barrier is the turnover of staffing really impacts on workers' ability to engage with children and young people and build relationships. Some practitioners even say they don't want to get too close because of this turnover and movement of staff. So some of the worker and structural barriers are things that we need to think very carefully about and how they can be best managed. But there's also barriers from children and young people taking up the opportunities to talk to adults. And this might be because they have a desire to shield their emotions from others so as not to be a burden, or the situation is too sad for them and upsetting to talk about, or they're scared of the consequences of talking to other adults, for example, in disclosing violence. And they're very worried that, in fact, talking to adults, and this might be their experience, actually leads to things becoming worse for them. And finally, when children and young people might want to talk to an adult, no one might be available. There's often a lot of children and young people who don't have a designated caseworker that they can build a relationship with. A lack of trust in others and the length of time it takes to build trust with someone is really key to children and young people maybe wanting to speak to practitioners. Previous experiences where their views and experiences of being ignored or misrepresented is also a barrier. They might be worried about not being believed. And they might actually have a lack of confidence that anyone would be able to help them or support them. These are all things that skillful practitioners really need to overcome with young people. Because, as this 16-year-old young man said, because talking to people takes a big load off your chest, like a huge weight is lifted off you. So there does need to be more people, because it's hard to talk to people and you've got to trust them a lot. There are not many people that I can trust, that I can tell. So these are really key aspects of what might get in the way of practitioners talking to children as much as they would like. It might be worth thinking about what would you do more of when you're thinking about talking to children, and how would you go about engaging with a young person whose trust is pretty minimal? Now I want to talk about the sort of broad principles that underpin child-centered practice. This goes beyond talking about children's participation, but it is key to thinking about a practice that is child-centered. And when we're thinking about a child-centered way of working, it's important that we have our policies and program and practice settings right at all levels, that we can implement some of these key aspects of child-centered practice. The first thing is allowing for a relationship-based approach, taking into account the important relationship in children's lives and the potential relationship you can have with the child and the family, and the effect of the service intervention on these relationships. Very key in the area of child welfare. We need to ensure that our intervention with families is timely, taking into account that the critical timeframes in childhood and assisting children and young people as early as possible, early in the life of the child and early in the life of the problem, or so it's said. This includes taking into account the developmental needs of children and young people and being aware of these developmental needs in all our interactions with them and their families. And we strongly believe that we need to provide children and young people with these appropriate opportunities to participate in all aspects of the interaction that affect them. And finally, the last pin to the child-centred framework is to promote a collaborative approach to the care, protection and wellbeing of children, which includes the strengthening of networks and interactions in all of the child's multiple environments, their family and home and their school and within their community and wider society. So working with kids is clearly more than just about their safety and protection. A child-centered focus means that children are on your radar at all times, and that you don't assume they're okay or not okay, and that you give their needs the highest of priority. Ideally, it's about talking and engaging the children directly. However, you can build a child focus into your work, even in situations where it can be done indirectly. And one obvious example of this is when children are tiny babies, and how being child-centred really is about observation and reporting of adults. It helps you to be aware of each child's needs and will influence the way that you support children and their families. In practice, we came up with six key child-centred principles. The first thing is that children and young people's safety and wellbeing are of primary importance. Secondly, that children are individuals that have unique needs and wishes. Three, because children are usually best supported within their family, every effort should be made to assist families to support their children. Four, that environments surrounding children need to be child-centred and child-friendly and provide them with opportunities to develop and grow and to have fun. That children need to be provided with information and given opportunities to participate in processes that affect their lives, and that the best outcomes are often achieved in partnership with others who can assist children and families in an ongoing way. Okay, so if we took one of these, which is children and young people are individuals, then what do we need to think about when engaging with children? Well, the first thing is seeing each individual child and young person as unique and special. And we could do this by discovering what's important to the child or young person. Do they like to play soccer? Do they enjoy school? Do they play video games? What is important to that child and young person? Are they very close to a sibling? Is their grandmother someone who's a key supporter of them? And wherever possible, this really is necessary to be able to talk to children directly about discovering what is important to them. When engaging, we need to understand the child or young person's context. So being aware of the circumstances of their lives, the family that they're currently living in, what sort of cultural background, what sort of language and diversity experience they have, what their needs and abilities are, and where are they in terms of age and stage of development. That then enables you to provide creative and flexible responses that fit the child and young person and respond to their diverse needs. And you need to be aware of how your personal and work contexts may affect responses to a child. This might be how you actually see some children as not really very competent or being incredibly clever, or the work context that means you're very busy and how you're going to manage that and how you're going to affect those responses to that child. So let's talk about some of the really amazing tools that are out there. But before we talk about some of the my favourites or commonly used tools that we have taken from practice and use in research, I want to think about a number of things before you choose any tool. The first question is, why are you using it? Why are you using this tool over that tool? Or why are you using a tool at all? Who are you using it with? What is it about the child and their interests and their capacities that mean that this tool could be a useful one? Does the tool need to be adapted in some way? Is it too childlike or is it too advanced? So is there some way that you can adapt it by taking language out or drawing things differently? It's really important to think about the practical considerations, like how much time you have available. Do you have enough time and resources available to you? Because you shouldn't start something you can't finish in an appropriate and safe way. And finally, think about the hazard zones that could emerge in the conversation with children, and be prepared to be ready to have the conversations you might be opening up. So the first tool I want to talk to you about, it's very funny doing this on a podcast rather than you being able to see these things, but you might have heard about them. They're called Komochis, and I'll make sure that the website links are on the PSP Learning Hub. Komochi is a Japanese word meaning feeling, and these little colourful pillows have a face on one side and a feeling that represents the face on the other side, and children can choose these really sweet little colourful pillows to be able to start to talk about their feelings. And they're often useful when you check in and check out of a conversation with a young person or a child. So you're starting off by seeing how they're feeling and checking out before you go home and ensuring that they're feeling pretty good and okay about that discussion you just had. The Komochi company, the komochis.com, also have some fantastic, beautiful feeling cards that do the same thing, that enable children to be able to identify what feelings they have. Another really good resource is St. Luke's Innovative Resources, and one of my favourites is the Funky Fish cards, which have fantastic photos of fish, which sums up how you might be feeling about something that you can use. And they're very, very gorgeous. St. Luke's Innovative Resources have a big range of resources for you to be able to talk to children. It's worth having a look at if you haven't seen them at all. But one tool which I particularly liked, which is not about cards or buying Komochis, is an example a practitioner gave us in a research recently where he said that when he finished the conversation with the child, he would go back to his office and he would either email or write a letter to the child identifying what they talked about, what he said he would do, and when he would get back to the child. So it was something like, "Dear John, it was so fabulous to see you today. It was great to hear that school's going really well. I said that I would see if I can talk to your child protection worker about increasing the amount of family time that you might have with your parents." This is a really simple example of where workers are holding themselves accountable to children and young people, or parents generally, is a way of really identifying, I heard you, this is what I'm going to do, this is when I'm going to get back to you. And you don't need to do it every time, but it really seemed to work very, very well. There's also resources on the Permanency Support Program website. So there's fact sheets on talking with children, which identifies tools such as the three houses, the Kids Central Toolkit, which is on the Institute of Child Protection Studies website, has got lots of tools. I mentioned the tools like Kamochis and Funky Fish, and there's all sorts of fantastic ones. But you don't really need all those tools. You can give children choice about what they might use. You might just play with a set of cards or talk in the car when you're going to a meeting, or talk while you're playing soccer or basketball or just chatting. So finally, what are some of the key messages I'd leave with you? The first is things like, I'm really interested in what you have to say and how you feel and how you think about things. I might see things differently to you, but for now I'd like to understand things from your perspective. You get to decide what we talk about and how much you feel comfortable to share. You don't have to answer any questions. You don't want to, and you can stop or take a break at any time. And as much as possible, you'll get to decide what happens to the ideas, feelings, and stories you share. And very important there to acknowledge any limitations, particularly around safety. The other things that are key, I think, are looking for what children are telling you verbally and non-verbally, being flexible and creative, getting to know children and what they're interested in, checking out that you've understood them correctly so they know you've heard them. And if a child chooses not to engage, this is also their right. But try to understand and give them multiple opportunities. And I would like to finish with a quote from Helen Roberts, who says, being child-centred means that you are willing and prepared to hear children, to listen to them, and then, more importantly, to act on what they have to say. These are all separate activities, some of which we might do better or more often than others. Speak to you next time.